time, and there'll be one every weekday from Monday through Friday this week at 9 a.m. that if you're interested in that topic. Okay. What's real interesting is that it turns out that there's going to be a debate on this on Friday at 9 p.m. or something like that on YouTube, and the two different people that are involved in that debate, both of them reached out to me within 3 days of each other, and having read that short little essay, the one guy made a video critiquing it. He's taking the side in the debate that the Apocrypha is scripture, it should be included in the Bible. And then the other guy, the other gentleman, wrote me, and he's taking the opposite position that the Apocrypha is not scripture, it shouldn't be in the Bible. And it turns out both of them read that short essay. Somehow they got a hold of it as they were doing prep work for the debate, and they both read it, and they reached out to me within 3 days. So just interesting the way things go. But if you're interested in that topic, every morning this week I'm going to be releasing a video at 9 o'clock. Some of them are longer than others. I don't think any of them are longer than like 45 minutes. The shortest one is like 20 minutes. And then I have one I have to record still tomorrow for Friday. I don't know how long that one is going to be. But if you're interested, check that out. If you're joining us right now live, if you go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down here under recent sermons. You can click on lesson 224 and then click on the link to the notes. And you can follow along with the notes as we go through today's lesson. So we have in front of us today lesson 224, the AV 1611, Early Sales, Understanding the Early 17th Century Bible Market. Okay, it's kind of what we're going to be talking about today. So in lesson 222, I laid out that over the next couple lessons, there would be three topics I wanted to discuss with respect to the AV when it was first published. We're going to talk about early reception, early criticism, and early sales. In lessons 222 and 223, we discussed the early reception of the AV as well as its early criticism, most notably at the hands of Hugh Broughton. This leaves one more topic that I would like to discuss before moving on, and that is the topic of early sales. Over the last two decades, three important essays covering a host of topics related to early sales have been written, right? These include, in 2005, there's an essay titled The Financing of the Authorized Version 1610 to 1612, Robert Barker and Combining and Sleeping Stationers by John Bernard. 2009, The King's Printers Book, The King's Printers Bible and Book of Common Prayer Monopoly by Graham Rees and Maria Wakely. And this essay is an extract from a book published by Oxford University Press titled Publishing, Politics, and Culture, The King's Printers in the Reign of James I and James VI. And then a couple years ago, 2020, The King James Bible, Crown, Church, and People by Kenneth Fincham was published. So these are important essays that speak specifically to the issue of early sales and the conditions of what the Bible market was at the time that the King James was published. Now, we looked at the King's printer a little bit in a previous lesson. We talked about the upper and the lower case and how they would lay out pages, and we went through sort of the process of physically setting up a page and what all went into all that, and we looked at the typeface and the page layout and all that. This is a related thing, but it's still different than what we've discussed before. So, over the course of the next couple of lessons, we will be surveying these important essays with the goal of building an understanding of the early sales of the AV. This is a complicated topic with many factors to consider. Therefore, we will begin by seeking to understand the prevailing forces of the early 17th century Bible market in England. In future lessons, we will consider the sales that were generated by these market conditions, as well as the overall value of the industry. There's statistics that have come out that have been uncovered in these essays that are fascinating related to the overall worth and value of how much the Bible market was sort of worth at this time that I think are interesting, and I've never heard anybody talk about it, so we're going to kind of look at that a little bit. So to accomplish this task, the current lesson will cover the following points. We're going to look first at the printing capacity of the King's printer. What did he have the capacity? How much did he have the capacity to print and publish? We're going to look at Bible production before the King James or before the AV, and then we're going to look at financing and printing rights. So those are And that's all being done with the goal in this lesson of trying to understand the 17th century Bible market, which is our first point. Okay. So in this lesson, we will be relying on the 2009 essay by Graham Reese and Maria Wakely titled The King's Printers, Bible and Book of Common Prayer Monopoly to frame our discussion of the topic. So our first subpoint then is printing capacity of the King's printer, right? So let's just jump right in. We're on page 2 for those of you that are following along online. Printing capacity of the King's printer. Reese and Wakely introduced their essay with the following sentiments. Quote, "The Leviathan of London printing firms, the King's Printing House, was the only begetter of the behemoth of books, the Bible in English." So in other words, did they have a monopoly to print?
Yes.
Okay. "In fact, the production of vernacular Bibles together with New Testaments and the Book of Common Prayer was to a large degree the point de trà of the King's printers in the reign of James I. Monopoly production of editions of these texts made the King's printers the mediators of artifacts which embodied the three inseparables of an official politics, the state religion, and an emergent national culture." So what they're getting at there is, because these guys have a monopoly over the printing of Bibles, are they really very influential on how people are receiving the Bible and how they're sort of mediating between the authorities, the powers that be, and the people as they are engaged in printing the text? "The King's printers could supply the market with Bibles and Testaments only because they had the productive capacity, and unless we have a clear understanding of that, we cannot understand either the King's printers or their output. They were eagles amongst the quarrelsome magpies and crows who otherwise represented the London book trade in the reign of James I." So in other words, is the King's printer head and shoulders above any other printers in London at the time, to put it a different way? Okay. "Neglected by modern scholarship because they did not publish Shakespeare or Johnson, they exercised their monopoly right to print texts belonging to a quite different and vastly more influential canon, the biblical and liturgical. Their business was, by London standards, enormous. If one measures productive capacity in terms of numbers of presses employed, the King's printers soared above their contemporaries in the trade. All lesser shops were limited in their theoretical maximum of two presses, but before our period, 1583, the Queen's printer ran 5 presses, and after it, 1668, the King's printer ran 6. While it is fair to guess that within our period they sometimes ran more, with this press capacity they were able to print many more editions and far more edition sheets in a year than any other printing house, not to speak of the fact that the editions themselves often had print runs far exceeding the 1,500 copies to which other printers were, in theory, restricted." So let's just sort of understand what they're saying. Are they saying the King's printer has more presses? Is the King's printer have the ability to make more print runs and print more pages per print run than any other printing house in London at the time? Okay, and they're also saying that because the King's printer is publishing liturgical and biblical material, there's been a sort of a dearth of looking into the history of this because people have focused more on the presses that were printing Shakespeare and other secular works of the English Renaissance, more so than the liturgical and biblical material that the King's printer was publishing. So does anybody have any questions about that point before we move on? Okay. Did you have a comment, Mike, or you? I can always tell when your wheels are turning.
Cogitating. Did the King's printer have a monopoly? That is, were they the only ones that were allowed to print?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. And they had to pay money for the right, as we'll see as we go through here. They had to pay the crown money for the right to publish the text. Okay, and this is an early form of copyright. We've talked about this before. I've covered it in my book, The King James Bible in America. People say all the time that the King James Bible was never copyrighted. That is only true in the modern sense and understanding of copyright. Did the Crown limit who had the right to publish and print the text through the Crown copyright or patent to print? Okay? So let's look at the bottom of page 2. The first topic that Rees and Wakely tackle in their essay is the matter of, quote, print runs, i.e., how many copies of a given work were printed at one time. According to the authors, in 1627, there was a lawsuit adjudicated between the king's printers that forced deputants, that means a person, we should have that in brackets, not parentheses, a person who makes a deposition or affidavit under oath to testify about these details. So let's just stop there. So there becomes in the 1620s a litigation over issues related to publishing, which leads now to a court action where our people sort of sworn to testify about what they know about Bible publishing. Okay. For the record, John Bernard's piece from 2005 titled "The Financing of the Authorized Version 1612 to 1611, I think that should say. I have to check that date. To 1612, Robert Barker and Combining and Sleeping Stationers deals with the nature of the litigation in great detail. Okay. Now look, I decided not to get into all the nuts and bolts of that because while I find it interesting, it would take probably a whole lesson just to talk about the nature of this court case. All you need to know for this, for the purposes of this class, is that this came to a head and there was a case about it in the British courts related to publishing and things related to the monopoly to print and who had the right, because things got a little bit muddy. So we're not going to follow Bernard's essay there because it's just too much. We don't need to do it. So we're going to look at a little bit more of a streamlined presentation here by Rees and Wakely. Look at page 3. Look at the quote. Let us take these points in reverse order, starting with print runs. In 1627, two deputants called to give evidence upon interrogatories during protracted and ferocious chancery suits fought between the king's printers testified unambiguously to the edition sizes which had been the norm in the preceding years. So understand, this is coming out through this court case being adjudicated, right? And so this is how we know this information, because of what is being given in these depositions. In 1627, John Bill declared the standard size edition of the said office are 6,000, 3,000, and 15,000 or thereabouts. 1,500, excuse me. Another deputant in a position to know was Robert Constable, accomptant and nephew to the dispossessed king's printer Robert Barker, and employed in the said office by the plaintiff, i.e. Barker, for the space of 10 years or thereabouts, Constable said that the usual impressions consisted of 3,000 to 6,000 copies. So understand, these figures are coming from these depositions. All right? These answers were to the 31st interrogatory, which asked for edition size. Have all the usual impressions consisted of 3,000 to 6,000 books as the Bible or the like? The phrase Bibles or the like is telling, suggesting that even very large books were printed in large editions. In short, the king's printers not only had at least three times the productive capacity of other printers, they could and did produce editions up to four times larger than those allowed to the rest of the trade. So this is all coming out through identifying what is being testified in these court records, right? So think about those statistics. The king's printer, okay, it says, in short, the king's printer not only had at least three times the productive capacity of other printers, they could and did produce editions up to 4 times larger than those allowed to the rest of the trade. So in other words, could they publish the rest of the trade under the table as far as capacity and volume? Okay? And to this one must add a generous extra margin of overplus or overplus copies, which Constable reckoned to amount to at least 400 copies on top of a run of 6,000. These overplus copies may well have been made more than many more than may be needed to make up for poor impressions, and would certainly have included workers' perks and a stock from which regular and bulk buyers might get free gifts. So in other words, are they publishing more pages than they need? Are they publishing more individual sheets and pages than they need to print full editions?
Yes.
Okay? And even the size of overplus allowed for by the King's printers seems to have been potentially much greater at much greater at 1/5 over the chosen print run that other printers may have put out at 1/40th over the print run. Now let me just make sure, does everybody understand what's going on here? Okay, so does the King's printer have a massive capacity for printing and volume? So if he's going to print, is he going to print more copies or overplus sheets than he needs to make complete Bibles? And this is one of the things that you have to understand about this, right? And it's a difficulty that some people, I don't think they've ever thought, they haven't maybe thought about it, or they haven't thought about it very clearly. What ends up happening is, let's say that the king, I'm just going to make a random example here for illustration. Let's say the king is going to make the king's printer is going to make 6,000 folio copies of the King James. Okay? Does he print more than 6,000 sheets of every page? Yes, and so what does he do? He keeps those in overstock, right? So the next time he needs to print a folio, is he going to go to the overstock, see what he has, and make adjustments on what he needs to print and publish based on what he already has in the overstock? So what ends up happening is, on many of these editions of the King James, do you have published editions that have old overstock pages in with newly printed pages? And so this makes figuring out things like printer errors and all of that just very difficult, because you could conceivably have pages that are from old print runs that are now bound into new published editions. Does that make sense? Okay. After establishing from court records that the King's printers possessed a greater productive capacity when compared with the other printers of their day, Rees and Wakeley turned their attention to the number of editions produced each year. Quote, as for the number of editions produced, let us take 1 year as an example. The year 1620 was an animus, I'm just going to give you the English, a remarkable or auspicious year. So in other words, is that a good year?
Yes.
Okay. For production, and a unsteady, unstable, shaky, inconsistent year for relations between the king's printers. So in other words, they're going to look at a particularly good year and try to compare it with a year that wasn't so good. All right. In that year, so this would be 1620, the king's printers produced 72 editions. That's a lot. 72 editions. Of course, the king's printer patent being what it was, 20 of these were proclamations, which generally ran to no more than a maximum of 3 sheets and probably no more than 1,000 to 1,300 copies. So in other words, are they all Bibles, or are they printing other things too? They're printing other things that the king wants printed, right? But the king's printer patent also covered editions of the Bible, New Testaments, and the Book of Common Prayer. So they're printing whole Bibles, Old New Testament, including Apocrypha at the time, and New Testaments, and the Book of Common Prayer. So they're responsible to print all of that. Okay. Let's see, where am I at? In 1620, this part of the business included thumping editions of the Bible, including the massive folio Welsh Bible, a modest single edition of the New Testament, no fewer than 7 editions of the Book of Common Prayer, as well as several mighty non-biblical folios and a number of other works of substance. Okay? So in other words, are they printing in an obscene amount of material?
Yeah.
When you count everything they're printing, proclamations from the king, the Book of Common Prayer, New Testaments, full Bibles, they're printing a ton. Turning next to edition sheets, the authors can draw some comparisons between the productivity of the king's printer with other publishers of the era. Quote, "Let us turn now to edition sheets, by which we mean a measure of productivity which begins with the number of sheets per exemplar of a particular edition." So, again, do they have to typeset all this by hand? So do they have to decide how many copies of this page they're going to press before they clear the deck and start with the next page? So let's say they're intending to make, let's just keep it easy, 5,000 copies of whatever they're printing. Are they going to only print 5,000 sheets, or are they going to print more than 5,000 sheets? They're going to print more in case they have problems with the binding, or some of the sheets don't turn out as well as they should. And so they're going to make more than they need. And then anything they don't use, are they going to store? Okay? To this end, we add the number of edition sheets per single exemplar of each and every other edition produced by the king's printer in a given year. This gives us a measure of output which does not depend on the size of the editions in question, which is usually unknown, and a measure of which may be compared with the output of any other printer. Take, for instance, 1620. In that year, the king's printers published approximately 1,800 edition sheets. Compare that with the output of another successful and highly productive printing house in the same year, William Stansby's. That's how I would say that, right? Stansby's output of edition sheets was relatively high at 722. So that was a high number, 722, but the king's printer is at what? 1,800, okay? But puny, let me start over.
Puny.
What is the word?
Puny.
But puny, sorry, let me start that sentence over. Stanby's output of edition sheets was relatively high at 722, but puny when set beside the king's printers. And to that fact, one must add that Stansby's print runs were half to a quarter less than the standard runs of the king's printing house. When it comes to stocking books, this has implications. The nature of their staples, Bibles, New Testaments, Book of Common Prayers, and the size of their output means the king's printers had to maintain and finance much larger stocks, and so sink larger amounts of capital into stock than any other Jacobin printing house. So in other words, when given the chance, are they going to make more sheets as a principle of economics because they have higher overhead, higher economic output to make all these additions? Now, you don't think about this stuff really when you pick up a, you don't think about this stuff when you think about the making of Bibles, but is there a lot of money tied up in this? Any comments before we move on?
Where do they get their money from?
Well, they're getting it from selling. They're getting it the same way any publisher gets, from selling Bibles.
But at first.
Well, we're going to get into that because the king's printer gets in trouble. He gets economically in trouble, and he has to take on other houses to help him meet demand, which now causes problems, which why in the 1620s there's a court case. Because it got all messy and mixed up, right? And remember, by the time you get to 1620, you got folios, you got quartos, you got octavos, you've got, I forget the one that starts with a D, you've got all these sizes, you've got full Bibles, you've got New Testaments, you've got the Book of Common Prayer, it really starts to hurt your brain when you think about all the factors that are going into this, okay, and how much money the king's printing house is having to expend in capital to make all this happen. Okay? So, any other questions? So just to underline the points made so far, we may ask how many perfected sheets in total the King's Printing House printed in our sample year. Even if we assume that the maximum size was 1,500, a figure much lower than the norm, and multiply that by the number of edition sheets produced, 1,800, we arrive at the truly phenomenal sum of 2,700,000 perfected sheets in 1620, a sum equivalent to 5,625 reams of paper. Okay? In other words, we have a quantity which could only be produced if six presses were working at absolute full strength for 300 days. Okay? We need to take out that page number reference. Which, with due allowance for Sundays and holidays, means in effect a whole working year. So they are responsible for over 5,000 reams of paper to pull this off, the King's publisher. Okay. In addition, given King's printer edition sizes, 2,700,000 is no doubt an impossibly low total for a year, unless we assume that some editions with a 1620 imprint were begun in 1619, or that the King's printers made more than six presses, or they farmed out work to other printers. So in other words, there you go. Are they going to have to subcontract? And that's where things start to get what? Messy economically, because who's supposed to have the patent? The King's printer. If he subs out work to other contractors to meet demand, yeah, but now what do you do economically with that is sort of the point. As yet, we have found no evidence for the third possibility and have yet to examine the first. So in the meantime, we tentatively assume the second. So in other words, they're assuming so far in the essay that they had six presses, I believe, is what they're assuming. The King's Printing House was a business on a grand scale, and knowledge of that scale is a foundation of knowledge of all its operations, not least its production of Bibles and New Testaments. So, I'm trying to impress upon you the size and scale of this work, okay? So, does anybody have any questions before we look at the next subpoint?
Just a comment. I was wondering if they had a standard print sizes in those days. Now we have 8.5 by 11 as our standard. If they had a folio edition, if you took two 8.5 by 11 sheets, it's even bigger than that.
Right.
And so they had to have stocked these very large sheets of paper. I don't know how.
Yeah, the folio edition was intended for pulpit use. So in other words, that's a big Bible on par of the size of the Great Bible that was designed to be used in a lectern in a church service. And that's why very early on they start publishing smaller personal sizes. Okay? But yes, I would say they had at least three standard sizes, a folio, a quarto, an octavo. Later on they add another one. Starts with a D. I don't remember how to pronounce it. So, and they all are published. So imagine having to keep all that straight. All this paper, all these, the three different sizes, it's like it makes my brain hurt having to even think about it. Okay? The paper was different. I have that page. I brought it in before of that 1611. It's almost like a
fiber.
It's almost like a cloth.
It's like our money. It's like our money.
Yeah, it's more like the paper money's printed on. Yeah, that's a good comparison. Anybody have any other questions before we move on to the next point?
It's just that, like back then, everything was like the paper was all handmade. You didn't have
and it wasn't cheap back then.
You didn't have a paper mill.
It was very expensive.
All the type.
It's all the type, the ink, everything. The staples, the staple, all the, you know, it's crazy. Okay. Okay, so subpoint number two, Bible production before the AV, so before the King James. And then in the next subsection, recent Wakeley survey the production of the King's printer before the publication of the AV in 1611. Quote, so much for the capacity which enabled the King's printers to produce Bibles and books of common prayer on the scale that they did. We now pass on to consider the products themselves. The King James Bible, first printed in 1611, and the greatest novelty in Bible production in our period, was but the latest comer, of the three versions of Holy Writ produced by the King's printers. Before 1611 and after it, the bishops and Geneva Bibles and New Testaments were still current. Okay? So before the King James, were they publishing Geneva's and Bishop's Bibles? Okay? The Bishop's Bible, a revision of the Great Bible undertaken by Matthew Parker, 1504 to 1575, assisted by the bishops and biblical scholars, was first issued in folio by Richard Jugg in 1568. In the main, it corrected the Great Bible by drawing on the Hebrew and Greek originals and was influenced in its translation by the prophetical books by the Geneva Bible. In April 1571, the Convocation of the Province of Canterbury ordered every cathedral, as far as possible, every church to acquire a copy, and ordered every ecclesiastical bigwig to display one in his house for the benefit of servants and guests. A second folio was issued in 1572 by Richard Jugg. In this edition, the New Testament had undergone further careful revision, which arising from a memorandum by Giles Lawrence, was used in later editions of the Bishop's Bible, while the rest of the text, the Old Testament Apocrypha, remained as it was in the first folio. It is this 1572 that amends love to charity in like 26 places. Okay? So when you have a King James Bible and you see charity in like 26 or 29, the number is exactly escaping me at the moment, it is this Bishop's Bible that made that change. The first edition of the Bishop's Bible from 1568 had love in all of those places, and it's this one from 1572 that makes the change. Anyway, by a nice irony of history, Barker did not print any edition of the Bishop's Bible in James's reign, but provided 40 copies of his last folio printing, 1602, for the translators who were to prepare the King James Bible, the text of whose printing was to accelerate the decline of his fortunes. Okay, now, we've said this before. The King's printer provided the translators with 40 unbound copies of a 1602 Bishop's Bible. Okay, let's read on. However, he did print two editions in 1606 and 1608 of the Bishop's New Testament in 8. So I take that to mean in octavo size. That's what I take 8 to mean here.
Is that what that little O is?
I'm pretty sure. Because nothing else made sense to me as I looked into this. Okay, so I'm going to go with that until somebody corrects me from the internet, which I know they will if I'm wrong. Okay, so in 8 before 1611. So they printed octavos of the New Testament in 1606 and 1608 before 1611. These and earlier small format editions of the Bishop's New Testament were those known as cheek? Yes? Cheek?
Yeah.
Or cheeks? New Testaments. A designation under which at least one edition appeared in a King's printer stock list of 1624 to 1625. Get rid of the 15 there, Sylvia, at the end, if you would, please. So, in the pre-King James years, the Geneva Bible's fortune was markedly different from that of the Bishop's Bible. Popular from its first appearance in England soon after the beginning of Elizabeth's reign, no doubt because of its Calvinistic coloring and its many annotations, it had been translated by William Whittingham, Anthony Gilby, Thomas Sampson, and perhaps other exiles in Geneva. First printed by Ruland Hall in Geneva in 1560, its Old Testament and Apocrypha were based mainly on the Great Bible corrected from the original Hebrew and Greek, and compared with Latin versions by Leo Judah and others. Its New Testament ascribed to Whittingham was based on Tyndale's version, compared with the Great Bible and influenced by Beza's Latin translation. The Geneva New Testament was further revised twice. We've talked about all this before. Lawrence Thompson did it, produced a rendering with alterations stemming from Beza's Latin version of 1565. This was printed in octavo, eighth, I'm saying octavo here, in 1576 by Christopher Barker, Robert's father. So Christopher Barker is Robert Barker's father. He's the Queen's printer, Christopher Barker. Okay? This became the final and popular form of the Geneva New Testament, 17 except for Revelation, which is Junius's version, superseded Thompson's in some editions of the Geneva New Testament and Bible, beginning with the 1602 octavo printed by Robert Barker. Given that not a single edition of the Bishop's Bible, as distinct from the Bishop's version of the New Testament, was issued by the King's printer in the reign of James, Robert Barker's output of Geneva Bibles in the period was, by comparison, astonishing. From the accession of James to the appearance of the King James Bible in 1611, 24 editions of the Bible were produced, including 15 editions in fours, which I'm saying quartos, and eighths, which I'm saying octavos, seven editions in octavo, and two folio editions. So that would be the big, huge one, okay? After these 24 editions, 17 were unrevised Geneva versions, six were the Geneva Thompson Junius, and one Geneva Thompson. In the same period, 1603 to 1611, Barker put out 10 editions of the New Testament, of which two were Bishop's versions in octavo and eight in Geneva versions, mostly in the Thompson or Thompson and Junius form. Of the Geneva New Testaments, one in octavo and two in 16. So I don't know what that means. Okay? And five in 24 in 12. So I seriously looked at a bunch of stuff. I'm not totally sure what these numbers mean. I know they're talking about sizes. That's all
I couldn't find it.
Yeah. What we have here, though, is a truly prodigious output with an annual average of over one edition of the New Testament and a striking average of 22 to 3 Bible editions per annum. That's a year, right? No other printer in the Jacobin period published repeat editions of such long works. The Bible runs to some 783,000 words, and no other printer had the capacity to do so. Yet for Robert Barker, production on this scale was efficient, absolutely routine, and quite relentless. When stock of an edition in one format in English or in Roman type began to run out, another such edition would be churned out, and especially in regularly large quarto, I'm saying, and octavo format. If that's wrong, again, I'm sure the internet will correct me. So again, do they have an astounding capacity here for publication? Yeah. According to Reason Wakely, the advent of the King James Bible in 1611 made life for Robert Barker, the King's printer, quote, a misery. In fact, they suggest that economic factors and financial woes forced Barker to yield exclusive printing rights in the AB to other London printers. Quote, the market for Bibles and New Testaments must have seemed insatiable, and the profits to be made from it unfailingly reliable. However, as Barker was going about his routine and lucrative business, proposals were adopted and implemented for what would result in a new translation of the Bible, a translation which was to become the King James Bible or authorized version, and in the end make Barker's life a misery. So, this is not going to be kind to the King's printer, all right? The fact was that control of the Bible was an imperative of the early modern British state, and no one was more alive to that than James I, and no one was more keen to use the press to propagate books, King James Bibles among them, which encouraged the consolidation of an official national culture. So does James view this as a policy of state to have these things printed and printed accurately? Okay. Indeed, just a few months after his ascension, he convened the Hampton Court Conference, which set on foot the new translation. The translation sent to the press in 1611 could not have had a more profound effect on the king's printing house, for the King James Bible was one source of the financial woes which eventually helped betray Robert Barker into the hands of John Bill and Boham Norton, gave the latter pair the king's printer patent, and established them as a dominant force in the London printing for a decade. So this is where we get to the litigation in the 1620s. Because Barker financially cannot keep up. And so does he have to take these guys on to help him meet demand? And in doing so, does he in effect lose his print patent? Is, in a nutshell, it's way more complicated than that. But again, that's an interesting story. I could tell you what to read if you want to know about it, but it's just way into the weeds for where we need to be. Does anybody have any questions or comments? Okay. So this will cover it to some degree. Hopefully we have enough time to get through this. Printing or financing and printing rights is subpoint number 3. The story of securing the printing rights necessary to print the AB is a long and sordid tale with many twists and turns. Quote, whatever the manuscript or marked up text which Barker used as a copy text for the edition Princeps of the King James Bible, he may have actually had to pay big money to secure his right to. In a pamphlet of 1651, William Ball noted that Matthew Barker had the sole right to print Bibles and Testaments because his father had paid 3,500 pounds for the amended or corrected translation, by reason whereof the translated copy did of right belong to him. So, 3,500 pounds, that's a lot. Somebody get out Google and do a calculate. I think it'll probably calculate that, but that's a lot of money. So, does he have to lay out a ton of money to even get the right to do it before he's even made anything, sold anything, and recouped any money? Okay? So is there any truth to this account? What if anything, did Barker have to pay for the text of the King James Bible in whatever material form it took as an ancestor of printer's copy or as an actual printer's copy? Common sense would suggest that even asking this question might amount to an act of super... how do we say this word? Supererogation? Supererogation?
Supererogation.
Supererogation. Yeah, I'm sure you're all familiar with that word. For surely the king would have expected Barker to pay for the privilege of printing a very costly edition at his own expense. However, we are not dealing with common sense, but the policies of book production on behalf of the state. And so the question of payment must remain a serious consideration, not least because of a tantalizing new piece of evidence given in a 1611 Chancery deposition by Robert Constable. So here's a quote of this. This is in Old English. We'll do our best here. We knoweth that since the assignment of the said office made to Norton and Bill, Barker hath yearly paid for Cheat's Testaments £10 unto one Mr. Dawson, of whom as this deputant hath heard and taken it. Barker bought the same and said that he doth know that the said Barker before the said assignment did without interruption, I'm assuming, only print the said New Testament, and did pay yearly, and the said annuity to Dawson for the same. And for the new translation of the whole Bible, this deputant saith, he can say now other than he hath heard Barker say, and the same was given to my Lord's Grace of Canterbury by the king, and that he, Barker, was fain to buy the same and to cost him something, £1,000 to that effect.
4,000.
4,000? Okay, so is this an early sworn document from 1612 that Barker paid roughly £4,000 to the right to print? Did you do some figuring there, Amy?
$4,421.55.
Would be in today's money?
Yeah, today's money.
Okay. So let's look at the next paragraph. This appears to corroborate the 1651 statement and to go beyond it. Barker did have to pay for the right to the King James Bible with James, which James had given to the Archbishops of Canterbury, and instead of the £3,500 mentioned in the 1651 source, we had obliged to pay £4,000. So in other words, is there a discrepancy in the amount here based on which source you look at? If you look at the 1619 source, it's 4,000. If you look at the 1651 source, it's £500 less. Okay? Now, let's go to the next sentence. This was a very large sum. So, it doesn't matter. Was it a lot of money? This was a very large sum, and so it is no wonder that Barker may have been put to... This is Latin. We'll just skip the Latin to find money. And that he perhaps paid the sum not with ready money, but a combination of installments, mortgages, or payment in kind, i.e. books. So in other words, does he have all the money on hand to pay the whole amount? Possibly not. So now does he have to mortgage things to gather the money to buy the rights so that he can print the text? So this is sort of the beginning of his financial problems. If Constable was right, Barker's shifts could have relieved the financial pressure that intensified as he set about printing the King James Bible. But is Constable's testimony reliable? To this one can reply that he had a remarkably clear understanding of the affairs of the King's printing house, that he was right about the deal between Dawson and Barker, and the facts he gave regarding the King James Bible were independently verifiable at the time when they were made. But it is also true that no other deputant in the King's Printer Chancery case mentioned the matter. So Barker now had the rights to the text in what form it came to him for the King James Bible, but if he had been obligated to pay £4,000 for the privilege, his first efforts to act on the privilege brought him more trouble. A seminal article by John Bernard, that's the one I referred to earlier, on the financing of the King James Bible draws attention to an action in the court of Exchequer in 1613 by Boham Norton. The action was brought against individuals who had been erstwhile partners of Boham, recently deceased cousin John. This partnership had brought a very large number of books, Bibles, New Testaments, and books of common prayer from Barker in 1610 to 1612. So is Barker now bringing in another publishing house to help him meet demand? That's the way I understand this, right? At John's executor, Boham wanted to recover John's share of the profits from the surviving partners, profits gained from the sale of the purchases from Barker. So Barker did sell him some rights to print. Okay? The Exchequer case was eventually settled out of court, but there is reason to believe that some of the Bibles acquired by John Norton's syndicate were copies of one or both of the 1611 folio editions of the King James Bible. There's also reason to believe that in selling them wholesale to the syndicate, a syndicate which turned out to be in effect a front organization for the partnership of Bill and the two Nortons, Barker received a poor return on his capital, and that market and that market power drained away from him and flowed with greater rapidity towards Bill and the Nortons. So is he making a bad investment here? And is he losing money and is he losing market because of what he's doing here? Okay? In fact, this was a pivotal moment in the ancient rivalry which divided the Barkers and the Nortons. As John Bernard has showed, the rivalry dated back to the mid-1570s when William Norton, Bohan's father, and others banded together to publish with Richard Jugg, the then Queen's printer, a five-part quarto bishop's Bible, 1575, to forestall a forthcoming folio edition of the Geneva Bible, 1576, printed by Christopher Barker, Robert's father. The publication of the Geneva Folio apparently put Christopher in a good position to succeed Jugg as the Queen's printer when the latter died in 1577, at which point Christopher gained exclusive rights to publish both the Geneva and Bishop's Bible, and that shut William Norton out of the English book trade. So look, do you have a publishing rivalry here that's going to now play out over who's going to have the right to publish? And this one family, are they looking for an opportunity to get back at the other family for shutting them out of the Bible market? So there's a lot of high drama here, right? Okay. Not one to be denied, William Norton became involved in a partnership which published Latin Bibles in the early years from his from 1580 until his death in 1593. Please remove the 30. In the following year, his son Boham, in partnership with John Harrison, published a Beza Latin New Testament, which in 1601, John and Bohan Norton attacked Robert Barker's monopoly by supporting Isaac Cannon's printing of a Bible in English at Dorchan. So now they go outside the country and they publish it. Not long afterwards, in 1605, John Norton again with Harrison published another Beza Latin New Testament, and yet another on his own account in 1610, and lastly Bohan and Bill printed yet one more in 1614. But by then, Bohan Norton and John Bill had already deeply implicated in the affairs of Robert Barker, and as we know, the rivalry, already 40 years old, was about to take on a new intricacy and eventually a new ferocity. So, are these guys really duking it out over who has the right to publish? Yeah. And is the King's printer going to lose money? Okay. Yeah, we'll finish. In addition to the essay we have been following by recent Wakely, John Bernard published a piece for Publishing History in 2005 titled The Financing of the Authorized Version 1610 to 1612, Robert Barker and the Combining of the Sleeping Stationers. Bernard's essay is very thorough and covers more ground than we have time or space to discuss. Therefore, we will limit ourselves to some of the summative comments offered by Bernard in Section 5. He says, quote, "The King James Version's publication is best understood as an early modern version of a private finance initiative, one that worked within the parameters of patronage and clientage, and in which the entrepreneur bore all the risks himself, unlike those of late 20th century or early 21st century printing, early 21st century Britain. The authorized version, fulsomely dedicated to James I, was a national enterprise. While the king undoubtedly encouraged the translation, the intellectual work of the translation was undertaken by scholars of the church and universities of Oxford and Cambridge. The translation was both a group and national enterprise involving the church and the universities, with at least two Cambridge colleges providing support in kind for the translating work over a four-year period. Similar support may well have come from other Oxford and Cambridge colleges. For its part, the Stationers' Company offered the book trade corporate support by providing premises for the work's completion. However, the financial underpinning of its publication was provided by two different joint ventures. The trade syndicate of individuals from within the Stationers' Company, headed by John Norton, pursuing profits for its investors, and the financial muscle of the covert Norton-Bill co-partnership with a similar aim to profit, which together provided the extra capital required to Robert Barker to manufacture the first editions of the King James Bible. So do these businessmen weasel their way in and thereby secure a portion of this for themselves and for their syndicate? You following that? The longer term aim of the Nortonville co-partnership, that of getting the monopoly of the Bible trade into their own hands, based on the partners' knowledge of Barker's financial difficulties, was realized. So do they see the King's printer struggling, and do they try to get their sole rights into their own hands by seizing upon an opportunity here? Okay, and that's what all this litigation is about later. This resulted in Robert Barker's downfall, but left Boham Norton and John Bill with a business which was to cause both men, but especially the former, major problems in their turn. So everyone who's involved in the early publication of the King James is a very sort of sordid affair in terms of the trade in the book publishing. Anybody got any questions?
Did they try to recoup finances by upping the cost of the Bibles? I mean,
well, that's a good question.
You
couldn't make them too expensive because nobody would buy them. But I think what ends up happening, that's partly why they end up making smaller sizes. Because the smaller sizes could be made more cheaply, they could be sold quicker, and they could be purchased by individuals instead of a big church folio Bible. Okay, so let's look at the last point. Conclusion, in the next lesson we will continue to unpack the nature of the 17th century Bible market by considering the following: the Jacobin Bible market, and then the difference between church versus private sales. Okay? Because you gotta understand, is an individual probably gonna buy a large folio Bible?
No.
They're probably not gonna buy it size wise, and they're probably not gonna buy it expense wise. But are they gonna buy possibly a smaller quarto or octavo size?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So you've got to distinguish between what's selling and to who. All right, and we'll start talking about that next time. Does anybody have any questions or comments?
So, like, let's say you have the Church of England.
Yep.
And then whoever's the Bishop of Canterbury or whatever, whoever makes the rules, and they say, you know, each parish or each church has to have one of these. How do they get paid for it?
Well, if
you're ordered, you know, you must have this Bible, but then how does
well, each parish church would have had to pay for their own copy.
So,
but here's what happens, okay? Remember that Bishop Bancroft dies in 1610, right before the thing is published in 1611. Lost in everything that happens is there was no such clear directive given from the episcopacy to the parishes that they had to buy one. So the buying of them at the parish level is uneven at first, which means they're not selling very well, which then causes diversification in the market to the smaller quarto and octavo sizes. That's my understanding of what ended up happening. So there never was an official directive from the Archbishop of Canterbury that the parishes had to buy it, because the Archbishop died in 1610, right on the eve of the thing being published. Now, later on, there's more clear directive given, like 5 years later in 1616, George Abbott is going to become the Archbishop of Canterbury, and George Abbott was a translator, and so the adoption of it by the parish churches of England is going to be slow and uneven because of some politics. But all that, we'll get into that next time. Anybody else with a question or comment?
So then too, I mean, if they needed to purchase a new Bible, so when they had their offering, they would say, hey, a little bit more.
Yeah, or they would just were good with the one they had until it wore out, and they didn't necessarily need to do that. So...